36. The alarm, which had indeed been built to warn Ludd's long-dead residents of an impending air attack, and which had not even been tested in almost 1,000 years, blanketed the city with sound. All the lights, which still operated, came on and began to pulse in sync. Pubes above the streets and grays below them were alike convinced that the end they had always feared was finally upon them. The grays suspected some cataclysmic mechanical breakdown was occurring. The pubes, who had always believed that the ghosts lurking in the machines below the city would someday rise up to take their long-delayed vengeance on the still-living, were probably closer to the actual truth of what was happening. Certainly there had been an intelligence left in the ancient computers below the city, a single living organism which had long ago ceased to exist sanely, under conditions that within its merciless dipolar circuits could only be absolute reality. It had held its increasingly alien logic within its banks of memory for 800 years, and might have held them for 800 more, if not for the arrival of Roland and his friends. Yet this mens non corpus had brooded and grown ever more insane with each passing year. Even in its increasing periods of sleep, it could be said to dream, and these dreams grew steadily more abnormal as the world moved on. Now, although the unthinkable machinery which maintained the beams had weakened, this insane and inhuman intelligence had awakened in the rooms of ruin, and had begun once more, although as bodiless as any ghost, to stumble through the halls of the dead. In other words, Blaine the Mono was preparing to get out of Dodge. 37. Roland heard a footstep behind him as he knelt by Jake and turned, raising his gun. Tilly, her dough-colored face a mask of confusion and superstitious fear, raised her hands and shrieked,
"Don't kill me, sire! Please, don't kill me!"
"Run, then," Roland said curtly, and as Tilly began to move, he struck her calf with the barrel of his revolver. "Not that way. Through the door I came in, and if you ever see me again, I'll be the last thing you ever see. Now go." She disappeared into the leaping, circling shadows. Roland dropped his head to Jake's chest, slamming his palm against his other ear to deaden the pulse of the alarm. He heard the boy's heartbeat, slow but strong. He slipped his arms around the boy, and as he did, Jake's eyes fluttered open.
"You didn't let me fall this time."
His voice was no more than a hoarse whisper. "No, not this time and not ever again. Don't try your voice."
"Where's Oi?"
"Oi!" the bumbler barked. "Oi!" Brandon had slashed Oi several times, but none of the wounds seemed mortal or even serious. It was clear that he was in some pain, but it was equally clear he was transported with joy. He regarded Jake with sparkling eyes, his pink tongue lolling out.
"Hey, Jake! Jake!"
Jake burst into tears and reached for him. Oi limped into the circle of his arms and allowed himself to be hugged for a moment. Roland got up and looked around, his gaze fixed on the door on the far side of the room. The two men he'd backshot had been heading in that direction, and the woman had also wanted to go that way. The gunslinger went toward the door with Jake in his arms and Oi at his heel. He kicked one of the dead grays aside and ducked through. The room beyond was a kitchen. It managed to look like a hog wallow. In spite of the built-in appliances and the stainless steel walls, the grays were apparently not much interested in housekeeping.
"Drink," Jake whispered. "Please. So thirsty."
Roland felt a queer doubling, as if time had folded backward on itself. He remembered lurching out of the desert, crazy with the heat and the emptiness. He remembered passing out in the stable of the way station, half dead from thirst, and waking at the taste of cool water trickling down his throat. The boy had taken off his shirt, soaked it under the flow from the pump, and given him to drink. Now it was his turn to do for Jake what Jake had already done for him. Roland glanced around and saw a sink. He went over to it and turned on the faucet. Cold, clear water rushed out. Over them, around them, under them, the alarm roared on and on. "Can you stand?" Jake nodded.
"I think so."
Roland set the boy on his feet, ready to catch him if he looked too wobbly, but Jake hung on to the sink, then ducked his head beneath the flowing water. Roland picked Oi up and looked at his wounds. They were already clotting. You got off very lucky, my furry friend, Roland thought, then reached past Jake to cup a palmful of water for the animal. Oi drank it eagerly. Jake drew back from the faucet with his hair plastered to the sides of his face. His skin was still too pale, and the signs that he had been badly beaten were clearly visible, but he looked better than he had when Roland had first bent over him. For one terrible moment, the gunslinger had been positive Jake was dead. He found himself wishing he could go back and kill Gasher again, and that led him to another thought. What about the one Gasher called the Tick-Tock Man? Did you see him, Jake?
Yes. Oi ambushed him, tore up his face, then I shot him.
Dead? Jake's lips began to tremble. He pressed them firmly together.
Yes, in his...
He tapped his forehead high above his right eyebrow.
I was lucky.
Roland looked at him appraisingly, then slowly shook his head. You know, I doubt that. But never mind now. Come on.
Where are we going?
Jake's voice was still little more than a husky murmur, and he kept looking past Roland's shoulder toward the room where he had almost died. Roland pointed across the kitchen. Beyond another hatchway, the corridor continued. That'll do for a start. Gunslinger! A voice boomed from everywhere. Roland wheeled around, one arm cradling Oi and the other around Jake's shoulders, but there was no one to see. Who speaks to me? He shouted. Name yourself, gunslinger. Roland of Gilead, son of Stephen, who speaks to me? Gilead is no more, the voice mused, ignoring the question. Roland looked up and saw patterns of concentric rings in the ceiling. The voice was coming from those. No gunslinger has walked in-world or mid-world for almost 300 years. I and my friends are the last. Jake took Oi from Roland. The bumbler at once began to lick the boy's swollen face. His gold-ringed eyes were full of adoration and happiness.
It's Blaine, Jake whispered to Roland, isn't it?
Roland nodded. Of course it was. But he had an idea that there was a great deal more to Blaine than just a monorail train. Boy, are you Jake of New York? Jake pressed closer to Roland and looked up at the speakers.
Yes, he said. That's me, Jake of New York, son of Elmer.
Do you still have the Book of Riddles, the one of which I have been told? Jake reached over his shoulder, and an expression of dismayed recollection filled his face as his fingers touched nothing but his own back. When he looked at Roland again, the gunslinger was holding his pack out toward him, and although the man's narrow, finely carved face was as expressionless as ever, Jake sensed the ghost of a smile lurking at the corners of his mouth. "You'll have to fix the straps," Roland said as Jake took the pack. "I made them longer."
"But Riddledy-Dum?"
Roland nodded. "Both books are still in there." "What you got, little pilgrim?" the voice inquired in a leisurely drawl.
"Cripes," Jake said.
"It can see us as well as hear us," Roland thought. And a moment later he spotted a small glass eye in one corner, far above a man's normal line of sight. He felt a chill slip over his skin and knew from both the troubled look on Jake's face and the way the boy's arms had tightened around Oi that he wasn't alone in his unease. That voice belonged to a machine, an incredibly smart machine, a playful machine, but there was something very wrong with it all the same.
"The book," Jake said. "I've got the riddle book."
"Good." There was an almost human satisfaction in the voice. "Really excellent." A scruffy, bearded fellow suddenly appeared in the doorway on the far side of the kitchen. A blood-stained, dirt-streaked yellow scarf flapped from the newcomer's upper arm.
"Fire's in the walls!"
he screamed. In his panic, he seemed not to realize that Roland and Jake were not part of his miserable subterranean quartet.
"Smoke on the lower levels! People killing themselves! Something's gone wrong! Hell, everything's gone wrong! We gotta—"
The door of the oven suddenly dropped open like an unhinged jaw. A thick beam of blue-white fire shot out and engulfed the scruffy man's head. He was driven backward with his clothes in flames and his skin boiling on his face. Jake stared up at Roland, stunned and horrified. Roland put an arm about the boy's shoulders. "He interrupted me," the voice said. That was rude, wasn't it? Yes, Roland said calmly. Extremely rude. Susanna of New York says you have a great many riddles by heart, Roland of Gilead. Is this true? Yes. There was an explosion in one of the rooms opening off this arm of the corridor. The floor shuddered beneath their feet, and voices screamed in a jagged chorus. The pulsing lights and the endless blatting siren faded momentarily, then came back strong. A little skein of bitter, acrid smoke drifted from the ventilators. Oi got a whiff and sneezed. "Tell me one of your riddles, gunslinger," the voice invited. It was serene and untroubled, as if they were all sitting together in a peaceful village square somewhere, instead of beneath a city that seemed on the verge of ripping itself apart. Roland thought for a moment, and what came to mind was Cuthbert's favorite riddle. "All right, Blaine," he said, "I will. What's better than all the gods and worse than old man Splitfoot? Dead people eat it always, live people who eat it die slow." There was a long pause. Jake put his face in Oi's fur to try to get away from the stink of the roasted gray.
"Be careful, gunslinger."
The voice was as small as a cool puff of breeze on summer's hottest day. The voice of the machine had come from all the speakers, but this one came only from the speaker directly overhead.
"Be careful, Jake of New York. Remember that these are the drawers. Go slow and be very careful."
Jake looked at the gunslinger with widening eyes. Roland gave his head a small, faint shake and raised one finger. He looked as if he was scratching the side of his nose, but that finger also lay across his lips, and Jake had an idea Roland was actually telling him to keep his mouth shut. "A clever riddle," Blaine said at last. There seemed to be real admiration in its voice. "The answer is nothing, is it not?" "That's right," Roland said. "You're pretty clever yourself, Blaine." When the voice spoke again, Roland heard what Eddie had heard already, a deep and ungovernable greed. "Ask me another." Roland drew a deep breath. "Not just now. I hope you are not refusing me, Roland, son of Stephen, for that is also rude, extremely rude." "Take us to our friends and help us get out of Ludd," Roland said. "Then there may be time for riddling."
"I could kill you where you stand," the voice said, and now it was as cold as winter's darkest day.
"Yes," Roland said, "I'm sure you could, but the riddles would die with us."
"I could take the boy's book."
"Thieving is ruder than either refusal or interruption," Roland remarked. He spoke as if merely passing the time of day, but the remaining fingers of his right hand were tight on Jake's shoulder.
"Besides," Jake said, looking up at the speaker in the ceiling, "the answers aren't in the book. Those pages were torn out."
In a flash of inspiration, he tapped his temple.
"They're up here, though."
"You fellows want to remember that nobody loves a smartass," Blaine said.
There was another explosion, this one louder and closer. One of the ventilator grills blew off and shot across the kitchen like a projectile. A moment later, two men and a woman emerged through the door which led to the rest of the Gray's warren. The gunslinger leveled his revolver at them, then lowered it as they stumbled across the kitchen and into the silo beyond without so much as a look at Roland and Jake. To Roland, they looked like animals fleeing before a forest fire. A stainless steel panel in the ceiling slid open, revealing a square of darkness. Something silvery flashed within it, and a few moments later, a steel sphere, perhaps a foot in diameter, dropped from the hole and hung in the air of the kitchen.
"Follow," Blaine said flatly.
"Will it take us to Eddie and Susanna?" Jake asked hopefully.
Blaine replied only with silence. But when the sphere began floating down the corridor, Roland and Jake followed it. 38. Jake had no clear memory of the time which followed, and that was probably merciful. He had left his world over a year before 900 people would commit suicide together in a small South American country called Guyana. But he knew about the periodic death rushes of the Lemmings, and what was happening in the disintegrating under-city of the Greys was like that. There were explosions, some on their level, but most far below them. Acrid smoke occasionally drifted from the ventilator grills, but most of the air purifiers were still working, and they whipped the worst of it away before it could gather in choking clouds. They saw no fires. Yet the Greys were reacting as if the time of the apocalypse had come. Most only fled, their faces blank O's of panic, but many had committed suicide in the halls and interconnected rooms through which the steel sphere led Roland and Jake. Some had shot themselves, many more had slashed their throats or wrists, a few appeared to have swallowed poison. On all the faces of the dead was the same expression of overmastering terror. Jake could only vaguely understand what had driven them to this. Roland had a better idea of what had happened to them, to their minds, when the long dead city first came to life around them and then seemed to commence tearing itself apart. And it was Roland who understood that Blaine was doing it on purpose, that Blaine was driving them to it. They ducked around a man hanging from an overhead heating duct and pounded down a flight of steel stairs behind the floating steel ball. "Jake," Roland shouted, "you never let me in at all, did you?" Jake shook his head. "I didn't think so. It was Blaine." They reached the bottom of the stairs and hurried along a narrow corridor toward a hatch with the words "Absolutely No Admittance" printed on it in the spiked letters of the high speech. "Is it Blaine?" Jake asked. "Yes. That's as good a name as any." "What about the other hush," Roland said grimly. The steel ball paused in front of the hatchway. The wheels spun and the hatch popped ajar. Roland pulled it open, and they stepped into a huge underground room which stretched away in three directions as far as they could see. It was filled with seemingly endless aisles of control panels and electronic equipment. Most of the panels were still dark and dead, but as Jake and Roland stood inside the door looking about with wide eyes, they could see pilot lights coming on and hear machinery cycling up. "The TikTok man said there were thousands of computers," Jake said. "I guess he was right. My God, look!" Roland did not understand the word Jake had used, and so said nothing. He only watched as row after row of panels lit up. A cloud of sparks and a momentary tongue of green fire jumped from one of the consoles as some ancient piece of equipment malfunctioned. Most of the machinery, however, appeared to be up and running just fine. Needles which hadn't moved in centuries suddenly jumped into the green. Huge aluminum cylinders spun, spilling data stored on silicone chips into memory banks which were once more wide awake and ready for input. Digital displays indicating everything from the mean aquifer water pressure in the West River Barony to available power amperage in the hibernating Send Basin nuclear plant lit up in brilliant dot matrices of red and green. Overhead, banks of hanging globes began to flash on, radiating outward in spokes of light. And from below, above, and around them, from everywhere, came the deep bass hum of generators and slow-trans engines awakening from their long sleep. Jake had begun to flag badly. Roland swept him into his arms again and chased the steel ball past machines at whose function and intent he could not even guess. Oi ran at his heels. The ball banked left, and the aisle in which they now found themselves ran between banks of TV monitors, thousands of them, stacked in rows like a child's building blocks. "My dad would love it," Jake thought. Some sections of this vast video arcade were still dark, but many of the screens were on. They showed a city in chaos, both above and below. Clumps of pubes surged pointlessly through the streets, eyes wide, mouths moving soundlessly. Many were leaping from the tall buildings. Jake observed with horror that hundreds more had congregated at the Seine Bridge and were throwing themselves into the river. Other screens showed large, cot-filled rooms like dormitories. Some of these rooms were on fire, but the panic-stricken Greys seemed to be setting the fires themselves, torching their own mattresses and furniture for God alone knew what reason. One screen showed a barrel-chested giant tossing men and women into what looked like a blood-spattered stamping press. This was bad enough, but there was something worse. The victims were standing in an unguarded line, docilely waiting their turns. The executioner, his yellow scarf pulled tight over his skull and the knotted ends swinging below his ears like pigtails, seized an old woman and held her up, waiting patiently for the stainless steel block of metal to clear the killing floor so he could toss her in. The old woman did not struggle, seemed in fact to be smiling. "In the rooms the people come and go," Blaine said. "But I don't think any of them are talking of Michelangelo." He suddenly laughed, strange, tittery laughter that sounded like rats scampering over broken glass. The sound sent chills chasing up Jake's neck. He wanted nothing at all to do with an intelligence that laughed like that. But what choice did they have? He turned his gaze helplessly back to the monitors, and Roland at once turned his head away. He did this gently but firmly. "There's nothing there you need to look at, Jake," he said. "But why are they doing it?" Jake asked. He had eaten nothing all day, but he still felt like vomiting. "Why?" "Because they're frightened, and Blaine is feeding their fear. But mostly, I think, because they've lived too long in the graveyard of their grandfathers, and they're tired of it. And before you pity them, remember how happy they would have been to take you along with them into the clearing where the path ends." The steel ball zipped around another corner, leaving the TV screens and electronic monitoring equipment behind. Ahead, a wide ribbon of some synthetic stuff was set into the floor. It gleamed like fresh tar between two narrow strips of chrome steel that dwindled to a point on what was not the far side of this room, but its horizon. The ball bounced impatiently above the dark strip, and suddenly the belt, for that was what it was, swept into silent motion, trundling along between its steel facings at jogging speed. The ball made small arcs in the air, urging them to climb on. Roland trotted beside the moving strip until he was roughly matching its speed, then did just that. He set Jake down, and the three of them, Gunslinger, Boy, and Golden-Eyed Bumbler, were carried rapidly across this shadowy underground plain where the ancient machines were awakening. The moving strip carried them into an area of what looked like filing cabinets, row after endless row of them. They were dark, but not dead. A low, sleepy humming sound came from within them, and Jake could see hairline cracks of bright yellow light shining between the steel panels. He suddenly found himself thinking of the TikTok man. "There's maybe 100,000 of those ever-fucking dipolar computers under the ever-fucking city. I want those computers!" "Well," Jake thought, "they're waking up, so I guess you're getting what you wanted, Tiki. But if you were here, I'm not sure you'd still want it." Then he remembered TikTok's great-grandfather, who'd been brave enough to climb into an airplane from another world and take it into the sky. With that kind of blood running in his veins, Jake supposed, TikTok, far from being frightened to the point of suicide, would have been delighted by this turn of events. And the more people who killed themselves in terror, the happier he would have been. "Too late now, Tiki," he thought. "Thank God." Roland spoke in a soft, wondering voice. "All these boxes. I think we're riding through the mind of the thing that calls itself Blaine, Jake. I think we're riding through its mind." Jake nodded and found himself thinking of his final essay. "Blaine the brain is a hell of a pain." "Yes." Jake looked closely at Roland. "Are we going to come out where I think we're going to come out?" "Yes," Roland said. "If we're still following the path of the beam, we'll come out in the cradle." Jake nodded.
"Roland?"
"What?"
"Thanks for coming after me."
Roland nodded and put an arm around Jake's shoulders. Far ahead of them, huge motors rumbled to life. A moment later, a heavy grinding sound began, and new light, the harsh glow of orange arc sodiums, flooded down on them. Jake could now see the place where the moving belt stopped. Beyond it was a steep, narrow escalator leading up into that orange light. 39. Eddie and Susanna heard heavy motors start up almost directly beneath them. A moment later, a wide strip of the marble floor began to pull slowly back, revealing a long, lighted slot below. The floor was disappearing in their direction, Eddie seized the handles of Susanna's chair and rolled it rapidly backward along the steel barrier between the monorail platform and the rest of the cradle. There were several pillars along the course of the growing rectangle of light, and Eddie waited for them to tumble into the hole as the floor upon which they stood disappeared from beneath their bases. It didn't happen. The pillars went on serenely standing, seeming to float on nothing.
"I see an escalator," Susanna shouted over the endless pulsing alarm.
She was leaning forward, peering into the hole.
"Aha!" Eddie shouted back. "We got the L station up here, so it must be notions, perfume, and ladies' lingerie down there."
"What?"
"Never mind."
"Eddie!"
Susanna screamed. Delighted surprise burst over her face like a 4th of July firework. She leaned even further forward, pointing, and Eddie had to grab her to keep her from tumbling out of the chair.
"It's Roland! It's both of them!"
There was a shuddery thump as the slot in the floor opened to its maximum length and stopped. The motors which had driven it along its hidden tracks cut out in a long, dying whine. Eddie ran to the edge of the hole and saw Roland riding on one of the escalator steps. Jake, white-faced, bruised, bloody, but clearly Jake and clearly alive, was standing next to him and leaning on the gunslinger's shoulder. And sitting on the step right behind them, looking up with his bright eyes, was Oi.
"Roland! Jake!"
Eddie shouted. He leaped up, waving his hands over his head, and came down dancing on the edge of the slot. If he'd been wearing a hat, he would have thrown it in the air. They looked up and waved. Jake was grinning, Eddie saw, and even old Long Tall and Ugly looked as if he might break down and crack a smile before long. Wonders, Eddie thought, would never cease. His heart suddenly felt too big for his chest, and he danced faster, waving his arms and whooping, afraid that if he didn't keep moving, his joy and relief might actually cause him to burst. Until this moment, he had not realized how positive his heart had become that they would never see Roland and Jake again.
"Hey, guys! All right! Far fucking out! Get your asses up here!"
"Eddie, help me!"
He turned. Susanna was trying to struggle out of her chair, but a fold of the deerskin trousers she was wearing had gotten caught in the brake mechanism. She was laughing and weeping at the same time, her dark eyes blazing with happiness. Eddie lifted her from the chair so violently that it crashed over on its side. He danced her around in a circle. She clung to his neck with one hand and waved strenuously with the other.
"Roland, Jake, get on up here! Shuck your butts, you hear me?"
When they reached the top, Eddie embraced Roland, pounding him on the back, while Susanna covered Jake's upturned, laughing face with kisses. Oi ran around in tight figure eights, barking shrilly.
"Sugar," Susanna said. "You all right?"
"Yes," Jake said. He was still grinning, but tears stood in his eyes.
"And glad to be here. You'll never know how glad."
"I can guess, Sugar. You can bet on that."
She turned to look at Roland.
"What did they do to him? His face looked like somebody run over it with a bulldozer."
"That was mostly Gasher," Roland said. "He won't be bothering Jake again, or anyone else."
"What about you, big boy? You all right?"
Roland nodded, looking about. "So this is the cradle."
"Yes," Eddie said.
He was peering into the slot.
"What's down there?"
"Machines and madness."
"Loquacious as ever, I see."
Eddie looked at Roland, smiling.
"Do you know how happy I am to see you, man? Do you have any idea?"
"Yes, I think I do." Roland smiled then, thinking of how people changed. There had been a time, and not so long ago, when Eddie had been on the edge of cutting his throat with the gunslinger's own knife. The engines below them started up again. The escalator came to a stop. The slot in the floor began to slide closed once more. Jake went to Susanna's overturned chair, and as he was riding it, he caught sight of the smooth pink shape beyond the iron bars. His breath stopped, and the dream he had had after leaving River Crossing returned full force, the vast pink bullet shape slicing across the empty lands of western Missouri toward him and Oi. Two big triangular windows glittering high up in the blank face of that oncoming monster, windows like eyes. And now his dream was becoming reality, just as he had known it eventually would.
"It's just an awful choo-choo train, and its name is Blaine the Pain."
Eddie walked over and slung an arm around Jake's shoulders.
"Well, there it is, champ, just as advertised. What do you think of it?"
"Not too much, actually."
This was an understatement of colossal size, but Jake was too drained to do any better.
Me either, Eddie said.
It talks, and it likes riddles.
Jake nodded.
Roland had Susanna planted on one hip, and together they were examining the control box with its diamond pattern of raised number pads. Jake and Eddie joined them. Eddie found he had to keep looking down at Jake in order to verify that it wasn't just his imagination or wishful thinking. The boy was really here.
"What now?" he asked Roland.
Roland slipped his finger lightly over the numbered buttons which made up the diamond shape and shook his head. He didn't know.
"Because I think the Mono's engines are cycling faster," Eddie said.
"I mean, it's hard to tell for sure with that alarm blatting, but I think it is. And it's a robot, after all. What if it, like, leaves without us?"
"Blaine!" Susanna shouted. "Blaine, are you—"
"Listen closely, my friends," Blaine's voice boomed. "There are large stockpiles of chemical and biological warfare canisters under the city. I have started a sequence which will cause an explosion and release this gas. This explosion will occur in 12 minutes.
The voice fell silent for a moment, and then the voice of little Blaine, almost buried by the steady, pulsing whoop of the alarm, came to them.
"I was afraid of something like this. You must hurry."
Eddie ignored little Blaine, who wasn't telling him a damn thing he didn't already know. Of course they had to hurry, but that fact was running a distant second at the moment. Something much larger occupied most of his mind.
"Why?" he asked. "Why in God's name would you do that?"
"I should think it obvious. I can't nuke the city without destroying myself as well. And how could I take you where you want to go if I were destroyed?"
"But there are still thousands of people in the city," Eddie said. "You'll kill them."
"Yes," Blaine said calmly. "See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. Don't forget to write."
"Why?" Susanna shouted. "Why, goddamn you?"
"Because they bore me. You four, however, I find rather interesting. Of course, how long I continue to find you interesting will depend on how good your riddles are. And speaking of riddles, hadn't you better get to work solving mine? You have exactly 11 minutes and 20 seconds before the canisters rupture."
"Stop it!"
Jake yelled over the blatting siren.
"It isn't just the city. Gas like that could float anywhere. It could even kill the old people in River Crossing."
"Tough titty," said the kitty, Blaine responded unfeelingly. "Although I believe they can count on measuring out their lives in coffee spoons for a few more years. The autumn storms have begun, and the prevailing winds will carry the gases away from them. The situation of you four is, however, very different. You better put on your thinking caps, or it's see you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. Don't forget to write." The voice paused. "One piece of additional input. This gas is not painless."
"Take it back," Jake said. "We'll still tell you riddles, won't we, Roland? We'll tell all the riddles you want. Just take it back."
Blaine began to laugh. He laughed for a long time, pealing shrieks of electronic mirth into the wide, empty space of the cradle, where it mingled with the monotonous, drilling beat of the alarm.
"Stop it!" Susanna shouted. "Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!"
Blaine did. A moment later, the alarm cut off in mid-blat. The ensuing silence, broken only by the pounding rain, was deafening. Now the voice issuing from the speaker was very soft, thoughtful, and utterly without mercy.
"You now have 10 minutes, Blaine said. "Let's see just how interesting you really are."
"40.
Andrew?" "There's no Andrew here, stranger," he thought. "Andrew is long gone. Andrew is no more, as I shall soon be no more."
"Andrew,"
the voice insisted. It came from far away. It came from outside the cider press that had once been his head. Once there had been a boy named Andrew, and his father had taken that boy to a park on the far western side of Ludd, a park where there had been apple trees and a rusty tin shack that looked like hell and smelled like heaven. In answer to his question, Andrew's father had told him it was called the Cider House,
Then he gave Andrew a pat on the head, told him not to be afraid, and led him through the blanket-covered doorway. There had been more apples, baskets and baskets of them, stacked against the walls inside, and there had also been a scrawny old man named Dewlap, whose muscles writhed beneath his white skin like worms, and whose job was to feed the apples, basket by basket, to the loose-jointed, clanking machine which stood in the middle of the room. What came out of the pipe jutting from the far end of the machine was sweet cider. Another man, he no longer remembered what this one's name might have been, stood there, his job to fill jug after jug with the cider. A third man stood behind him, and his job was to clout the jug filler on the head if there was too much spillage. Andrew's father had given him a glass of the foaming cider, and although he had tasted a great many forgotten delicacies during his years in the city, he had never tasted anything finer than that sweet, cold drink. It had been like swallowing a gust of October wind. Yet what he remembered even more clearly than the taste of the cider or the wormy shift and squiggle of Dewlap's muscles as he dumped the baskets was the merciless way the machine reduced the big red-gold apples to liquid. 2 dozen rollers had carried them beneath a revolving steel drum with holes punched in it. The apples had first been squeezed and then actually popped, spilling their juices down an inclined trough while a screen caught the seeds and pulp. Now his head was the cider press and his brains were the apples. Soon they would pop as the apples had popped beneath the roller and the blessed darkness would swallow him. "Andrew, raise your head and look at me." He couldn't, and wouldn't even if he could. Better to just lie here and wait for the darkness. He was supposed to be dead anyway. Hadn't the hellish squint put a bullet in his brain? "It didn't go anywhere near your brain, you horse's ass, and you're not dying. You've just got a headache. You will die, though, if you don't stop lying there and puling in your own blood. And I will make sure, Andrew, that your dying makes what you are feeling now seem like bliss." It was not the threats which caused the man on the floor to raise his head, but rather the way the owner of that penetrating, hissing voice seemed to have read his mind. His head came up slowly, and the agony was excruciating. Heavy objects seemed to go sliding and careering around the bony case which contained what was left of his mind, ripping bloody channels through his brain as they went. A long, syrupy moan escaped him. There was a flapping, tickling sensation on his right cheek, as if a dozen flies were crawling in the blood there. He wanted to shoo them away, but he knew that he needed both hands just to support himself. The figure standing on the far side of the room by the hatch which led to the kitchen looked ghastly, unreal. This was partly because the overhead lights were still strobing, partly because he was seeing the newcomer with only one eye. He couldn't remember what had happened to the other and didn't want to. But he had an idea it was mostly because the creature was ghastly and unreal. It looked like a man, but the fellow who had once been Andrew Quick had an idea it really wasn't a man at all. The stranger standing in front of the hatch wore a short dark jacket belted at the waist, faded denim trousers, and old dusty boots. The boots of a countryman, a range rider, or a gunslinger, Andrew? The stranger asked and tittered. The TikTok man stared desperately at the figure in the doorway, trying to see the face, but the short jacket had a hood, and it was up. The stranger's countenance was lost in its shadows. The siren stopped in mid-whoop. The emergency lights stayed on, but they at least stopped flashing. "There," the stranger said in his, or its, whispery, penetrating voice. "At last we can hear ourselves think.